All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and my website is weekendinterviewshow.com, but not for long, because we're building a new website. But if you just go to weekendinterviewshow.com, that's the site until we redirect it to the new one, so can't lose. I keep all the archives for you there in MP3 format. Also, I want to say real quick, next week, have the best congressman since, I don't know, he's better congressman than James Madison ever was. I don't know. Best congressman in American history, Ron Paul, will be on the show next week. Also, Charles Pena, formerly of the warmongering Cato Institute, now a regular contributor to antiwar.com, and also another antiwar.com regular, and the guy who runs BalkanAnalysis.com, Christopher DeLiso, will be here next week. And so definitely tune in for that. This hour goes out to Bill Bradford, the publisher of Liberty Magazine. He also died today. Hopefully he and Richard Pryor are cracking jokes in line on the way into the pearly gates. And also I want to say real quick, I read a great book called Carl Melcher Goes to Vietnam by Paul Clayton, and it's the first book of fiction I've read in at least a couple of few years, and I really liked it. It's pretty much a kind of personalized fictional tale of Paul Clayton's adventures in Vietnam. It's called Carl Melcher Goes to Vietnam. Great little book. I highly recommend that to all y'all out there. And also I should give a quick plug to Liberty Stickers. I made up all the good ones, and then I sold the company to Rick. So buy a bunch of stickers from him and tell him I sent you, and maybe he'll give me some more money. And also another quick plug for Derek's Martial Arts Gym. It's on East Alpine off of South Congress, available at dmag.us. He will teach you Muay Thai and Kali. South Congress here in Austin, Texas. All right, now to my second guest, real quick to introduce him, Anthony Gregory, my good friend. He works at the Independent Institute. He writes for LouRockwell.com, StrikeTheRoot.com, Liberty Magazine, if it still exists now, I'm not sure, and a few other places. Welcome to the show, Anthony. Welcome back, I should say.
Hi, Scott. It's good to be here.
Who else do you write for besides all the people I just listed?
Well, in the past I've written for The Libertarian Enterprise and Rational Review, and I've written for antiwar.com and some other sites. I've been picked up on some other sites and also written for some print publications. So the Future Freedom Foundation, I write for them.
Right.
I hate to start off by correcting you, but it's very sad that to lose Bill Bradford. He actually passed away 2 days ago.
Oh.
But, you know, it's sad to lose him and Richard Pryor.
Isn't it cool that you can't even say Richard Pryor's name without laughing barely, can you?
No.
At least cracking a smile.
No, I can't. He was wonderful. He was a truly great guy. And I should also say that, to answer your question, Liberty is going to be taken over by Stephen Cox.
Oh, that's great to know. Liberty Magazine will still be on the shelves. All right, everybody, we'll be right back to talk about the question of whether government protects us with Anthony Gregory from LouRockwell.com, among many other places. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Anthony Gregory. And bad luck for you. I like the bumper music so much this hour. I'm just rocking out, cutting into your time here. Anthony writes for MyPreciousLouRockwell.com, also for the Independent Institute, the Future Freedom Foundation, the Libertarian Enterprise, Liberty Magazine, Strike the Root, and probably 10 or 15 other places as well. Anthony, what Liberty sticker do you have on your car?
I actually have two stickers. The sticker from you that I have, it says, Franklin Roosevelt or Franklin D. Roosevelt, no longer the worst president in American history. And I get a lot of strange looks because, people don't know what to think of that. Most people who don't like our current president probably assume that FDR was a much better president because he's, you know, he's one of the gods of the mythology that we're taught in our schools. And so it does arouse some confusion, though. I've gotten compliments about it, so that's to your credit, coming up with that great slogan, Scott.
Oh, why, thank you, yeah. So anyway, you wrote this great article for LouRockwell.com called Does Government Protect Us? And basically what you do in this article is you kind of dispense with the moral problem that we libertarians are always bringing up, that, hey, taxation is extortion, and therefore it's wrong, and so therefore government is evil, end of argument kind of thing. And you basically skip that and just argue the practical question of whether government works or not for keeping us safe, right?
Sure. Well, all support for government seems to be directly related to the idea that government protects us from something, whether that's greedy capitalists, or, you know, foreigners, or terrorists, or dirty drinking water, or, you know, homosexual marriages, whatever it is. People want the government to protect them from other people and to kind of decide for all of society what's right and what's wrong and what's good and what's bad. And I think that in every case, we'd be better off without governments. By government, I mean, to be more precise, I mean states. Some people argue that, a family or a private association is a form of government by one definition. And, well, I don't want to get into definition arguments, so let's just say states, which are organizations that maintain a monopoly of legalized force in a geographic area. I think these are bad. I think these are criminal institutions by their nature, but aside from that, they don't do what's promised of them. They don't keep the peace, and they don't maintain, they don't make the economy run any better, certainly. And they don't protect society from bad cultural influences. I mean,
all right, well, let's see if we can break this down. By my count, the basic functions of the state are: one, national defense; two, defense from each other, criminal justice; the welfare state, the regulatory state; natural disasters, and I guess various kind of abstract ideas like USA as the thing that defines us all as being a member of it, that kind of thing. So let's just go ahead and go through these and see what arguments you have for the state making the problem worse rather than better. Let's start with national defense.
Well, the U.S. government hasn't really conducted much of what I would consider national defense for its existence. I mean, almost all of the wars, I only say almost because, you know, maybe there's this tiny one I don't know about somewhere, but I doubt it. They're all about going somewhere else, killing, invading. I mean, sometimes some of the U.S. government's fighting an enemy that's an evil state, but, you know, there are hundreds of evil states in the world, so that's not a big surprise. But it's often also teaming up with a bad state, dictatorships, tyrannies, and of course,
the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and that kind of thing.
Sure, and often our friend, you know, one year, the next year is our enemy. This was the case with the World War II, of course. The U.S. was helping Stalin. This was after Stalin and during Stalin had committed his worst crimes against humanity. Then all of a sudden, Stalin was so evil that the U.S. had to launch a permanent Cold War. Well, it wasn't quite permanent and ended, but it didn't end for very long before this war on terror. And you know, 9/11 was one of the biggest government failures in American history. If U.S. foreign policy defended us, then why were we attacked? We were attacked. If, you know, the people, the hijackers that the government says attacked the World Trade Center, they were attacking in response to U.S. foreign policy, and U.S. foreign policy didn't stop it from happening. It just stirred up the hornet's nest. I mean, this is an old argument, but it's true. None of this post 9/11 foreign policy has made us safer, made us less safe. As even a lot of the people in the government will admit, if they're asked the question, has the Iraq war, for example, made us safe? No, it's actually empowered Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is more decentralized now. It's
has more members.
It has more members, that's right. And
well, what about spreading freedom? Because, you know, Bush will admit that Iraq didn't do 9/11, but what he's doing in Iraq is he's going to bring freedom there so that people won't want to be terrorists anymore. That's the ultimate strategy to remake the Middle East, to force them into the 21st century and give them markets and self-government, and then they won't want to be terrorists anymore.
Well, there weren't. I'm unaware of anti-American terrorists coming from Iraq in the first place before this. Now there are terrorists there. There is Al-Qaeda there. There are people there who, you know, despite all of the U.S. meddling in Iraq up until the last few years, there didn't seem to be many Iraqis who really were bent on killing Americans. But now there are. And, of course, all this talk about freedom, it's a lie. The new regime, it's kind of a mix of a lot of things. It seems a puppet regime of the United States government. It's got, right after taking over and occupying Iraq, the U.S. instituted martial law and curfews and rounded up weapons and started instituting national income tax and all kinds of economic policies. Price fixing gasoline, shutting down newspapers, planning propaganda newspapers, torturing people. I mean, these huge torture dungeons filled with people, many of whom are most likely innocent of any crime.
Well, another problem with national defense is that basically the wars serve as welfare for people who have already made it in life, and their successful company has something that they can sell on contract to the government for 10 times its market value.
Oh, sure. Well, yeah. I mean, it's hard to imagine that the free market would emulate the government's defense at this cost. I mean, they spend between $400 and $500 billion a year now on so-called defense. Though that number is also very deceptive, as Robert Higgs has shown in some of his work. If you add in things like the Department of Energy's security for nuclear facilities, if you add in veterans' benefits and interest on past borrowing that was for the warfare state, the military budget, the amount that that Americans spend every year on militarism on the federal level is probably close to twice as much as the number that we see. So it's approaching $1 trillion a year, which is just obscene. This is thousands of dollars per American per year.
Right, and you know, I think it also doesn't include the cost of the war. They always exclude that. This is the $500 billion official number. That's just the annual budget for keeping a standing army standing around. That doesn't include the almost probably $500 billion that have been spent on the last couple of wars.
That's right. And, you know, they were spending hundreds of billions of dollars a year as it was, and then 9/11 came along, and they said, oh, now we need to spend money to go to war, to build up our defenses. We need to form this new Homeland Security bureaucracy. And, you know, it's kind of funny because we were always given the impression, weren't we, that the Department of Defense was supposed to be in charge of defending the security of the homeland?
Although be careful what you wish for, because then you just end up with the Northern Command running around and the new American Theater of Operations. I mean, it's hard enough to tell a cop from a soldier as it is without actually mixing the soldiers with them.
Oh, of course. I'm not wishing.
Oh, I know.
Bush, you know, he's talked about reversing the posse comitatus provision for using the military on American soil for law enforcement.
And I want to touch on what you said about the market would have never done this. This is not how free markets behave. There's no private company in the world where Dick Cheney could have been the CEO and said, all right, stockholders, we're going to raise $300 billion and aggressively invade and occupy this foreign country 2,000 miles away. he'd have been fired in a day. No board of directors is going to put up with a CEO like that. But you give these guys a Treasury Department and an IRS and a Marine Corps, and then they can turn around and do right what their investors would not have paid for.
That's exactly right.
All right, everybody, hold it tight right there. It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm talking with my buddy Anthony Gregory from the Independent Institute. Stay tuned. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Orton, and I'm talking with my buddy Anthony Gregory from LouRockwell.com, and we're talking about how the state's good for nothing. And,
I hate to interrupt, but I think that that's overstating it. The state's good for a lot of things. It's good for giving businessmen who wouldn't be able to fatten their wallets and become all that rich on the free market because they don't offer any services that anyone would want. It gives them a chance to get rich. And, of course, it benefits the state itself, the people who work for the state.
It's just not good for you and me. It's victims.
It's not good for what is promised of it, which is, uplifting the morality of society and spreading the wealth around equally, whatever that means. And it's not good for what people support it as being supposedly good for.
Right, and when we left off at the break, we're talking about national defense and really the fact that it's basically a myth. And one thing I wanted to bring up real quickly is a book by Andrew Bacevich called The New American Militarism. Have you gotten a chance to read that yet?
I haven't actually read it yet. I've read a few chapters.
Well, it's a really good book. Unfortunately for me and my audience, Bacevich doesn't do interviews on Saturdays, apparently. But he's a professor at the Naval War College, I believe, and a career military officer. And he writes in there about how, and this is something you and I touched on earlier when we were talking on the phone before the show, was the USA and basically the military state itself, the warfare state, as the symbol of who we are, and that basically there's really nothing left of America that makes us America anymore. We surely don't have the Bill of Rights or the Declaration of Independence to have in common anymore. And so basically all we have left is the power of our military force to win. And the more professionalized it is and the more specialized the military is, the fewer any of us have anything to do with it, the more we like it because it's just an exciting TV show at that point. It's nothing that we have to risk our lives in. And, you know, if you just walk around the average American city today, probably most people don't even remember there's a war going on. It definitely has nothing to do with their lives at all. And so, therefore, they kind of worship it more. It's the thing we have in common is the thing that none of us have in common in the real world. But we all have it in common through our television.
Well, I remember there was a poll a few years back, maybe about 2 years ago, about Iraq. And how many American deaths would you tolerate to fulfill whatever objectives are supposedly being fulfilled? And the generals and even the politicians, probably because they're aware of democratic pressure and they want to keep their jobs, both of those groups were more wary of American deaths than the American population, which it's very unfortunate, but the American population at large seemed to be willing at the time to tolerate, at least in the abstract, a higher number of American deaths. Of course, now we see people are finally starting to realize that this war has been a huge tactical, strategic, and moral blunder in every sense. It hasn't made Iraq more free. Of course, I don't need to tell your audience this. They hear some of the best journalists and experts on this stuff in the world on your show all the time, but it's turned it more into a theocracy, if anything, with an imperial holding where the government there seems to have a schizophrenic outlook on what to think of the counterinsurgency or the insurgency. I'm sure you saw something about how the state issued a statement in solidarity or in support for the insurgency.
Yes. Well, what happened was there was the conference in Cairo where various Iraqi groups met, and yes, they did in solidarity. Said that violent resistance against the Americans is okay, and that's when I guess it was the next day that Donald Rumsfeld came out. A few days later, Rumsfeld came out and said he wanted to rename the insurgents rejectionists.
Yeah, rejectionists.
Yeah.
Party poopers.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really odd that the U.S. has gone to this war that has turned the Iraqi government into a near theocratic regime with a Soviet-style constitution, a defense pact agreements with Iran and solidarity with Iran and solidarity with the anti-occupation forces. It's an entirely incoherent policy. You know, I'd oppose this war even if it were much less ludicrous than it is. But it just so happens that this is unbelievably ludicrous, this war.
Yeah, I think in Lou Rockwell's column that's up on LouRockwell.com today, he says it's the most obvious example and the perfect reducto ad absurdum.
Yeah.
for can government spread liberty? No, clearly they can't. Let's just look at Iraq for one second.
Sure.
All right, everybody. I'm talking with my buddy Lou. No, I'm not talking with my buddy Lou. I'm talking with my buddy Anthony Gregory from LouRockwell.com, and we'll be right back. It's the Weekend Interview Show. Everybody, I'm Scott. It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm talking to my buddy Anthony Gregory from the Future Freedom Foundation, the Independent Institute, LouRockwell.com, Liberty Magazine, Libertarian Enterprise, and a few others I forgot to mention. Anthony, according to Capitol Hill Blue, which I don't necessarily trust as a source, but he claims in the article that he's got three separate independent sources verifying the claim that when Bush was being briefed on... I guess it had something to do with Padilla or the Patriot Act. Oh, it's Patriot Act. Mr. President, the Patriot Act could infringe on the Bill of Rights in this way or that. And apparently, supposedly, Bush referred to the Constitution as just a, euphemism alert, gosh darn piece of paper. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, yeah, I read that story today. And I was thinking of passing it along, but I'm not sure about Capitol Hill Blue either.
Well, let's assume that he said it. For
okay.
the sake of argument, let's assume that we can run with this news story. Bush said that the Constitution is nothing but a GD piece of paper. What about
okay.
that?
Well, I think that, in a sense, it's horrible, because if you have a government that's supposedly... outlined in its functions by the Constitution, and the head of that government doesn't consider his oath to obey the Constitution and enforce it to be important, then at the very minimum, he's not doing his job, and he should be fired. So just from that angle, if you believe there should be a state and there should be a presidency, if you believe in constitutional government, Bush, well, I think he should be fired, impeached for crimes against the Bill of Rights, even aside from whatever he thinks he believes about it. It's obvious that he doesn't consider the constraints on the state in the Constitution to bind him. He doesn't, almost nothing he's done is constitutional.
Right, although Article 2 surely creates his job, doesn't it?
That's right. So if it creates a job, no, you might have been trying to get me to trying to get me to think about the Constitution itself. I don't really believe the Constitution works very well in restraining the government. It certainly hasn't in any meaningful sense since the Wilson and Roosevelt administrations, but probably since the Lincoln administration. And even before that, I mean, it didn't take very long for them to set up a national bank and under John Adams to pass the horrible Alien Sedition Act. They were violating the Bill of Rights and the Constitution all the way back, you know, immediately after the Constitution was ratified. And the Constitution wasn't really supported by the most pro-freedom, pro-decentralist founding fathers. The anti-federalists, the ones who were against the Constitution, they thought it was a reactionary step backward away from the more revolutionary Articles of Confederation.
Well, if you go back and read the Anti-Federalist Papers, you can see they sure called it out right.
Oh yeah, they were right. Yeah, they said that the Supreme Court would become a horrible institution. The presidency wouldn't be as restrained as people think. At the time, the Federalists, even the Hamiltonians, were saying, "No, the president won't be anything like a king. We can keep him in check with the impeachment." Well, and they'll know that any time they violate the Constitution, they'll be subject to impeachment. I'd be very hard pressed to think of a single president who didn't violate the Constitution, and at least a good dozen or so did so violently and in a way that caused immense human suffering and immense damage to human liberty. You'd think that these people would have been impeached if the Federalists were right. But we've only had two presidents impeached and one almost impeached who stepped down because of it. But that's not very reassuring. I mean, Clinton was impeached for lying under oath about his personal life, and I am not a fan of Clinton. He was a killer, mass killer at Waco and Serbia, and treated the Bill of Rights like toilet paper. But that's not what they went after him for. It's been a long, long time since they've really used Congress has used the Constitution to try to restrain the executive, which has really become the federal government itself. The federal government is the executive. It is the presidency. There is a...
Right, and you can even reduce that. Say the presidency is the commander-in-chief clause.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's become... It's a militarist, imperialist state that America lives under. It's the most powerful central state the world has ever seen, certainly with the largest budget and the most weapons. And yet, this the most powerful government in the history of the world can't keep order in Iraq. It can't keep order in Washington D.C., one city over which it has complete police control, and it's still one of the highest homicide rates in the country, largely due to their horrible gun control. But this just shows the government, even when it's given complete control and many resources, it still fails. This might be our only hope, that the government can't do everything that its rulers and bureaucrats and central planners want.
In the end, really, Bush is right, that liberty is inevitable. And they can try to stop it, but they really can't.
Yeah, and one example which is often invoked as a good anti-war on drugs argument, but it kind of works for the statism in general, is we know that in prisons, even maximum security facilities where the government's spying on everyone, it has control, their guards, their iron bars and checkpoints and searches of property, and you're under constant surveillance, there's still drug abuse and drug dealing. I remember years ago reading about how they found drugs on Charles Manson, and you'd think they'd be keeping a close eye on him. And if they can't make Charles Manson's prison cell a drug-free zone, then they can't do that to America. even if they turn America into a prison, and they can't bring about freedom. Freedom doesn't come from the state. Freedom pre-exists the state. It is part of our the fabric of reality. It's a natural right to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and the right to justly acquired property. We're born with these rights. The state exists outside of these rights. It claims to be there to protect them, but on balance, it surely violates them more than it protects them.
Well, you know the old libertarian joke. So you think they ought to sell heroin and vending machines on the public sidewalks? And the libertarian says...
Well, I don't know the joke.
The joke goes there shouldn't be public sidewalks.
Right. I would say it depends on who owns the sidewalk.
Yeah, exactly.
And sure, and that's another thing. A lot of the problems that conservatives have about the idea of more unrestrained liberty is they think that it will lead to a total decline in all social authority, cultural standards. But in fact, all of the good cultural norms and the civil society, civilization itself, these are advanced through the family, through voluntary associations, through religious associations, through the marketplace and community, and kind of a ground up community, the community standards, even common law, all came from the bottom up. The state just hijacked all this stuff and runs counter to it. And if we had more robust property rights, if we had a more propertarian society where all of this, these resources and land that's currently run by the state and owned by the state, if it were all handed over to private owners, if private owners maintained the levees in New Orleans, for example, if private owners maintained the streets where there's gang violence, where there's unruly behavior, a lot of these problems would go away because people care about what they own. The state doesn't, it's not their money, it's not their resources. They have control over them, but they can always get more just by looting us or printing up more money with the printing press. So
on the drug war, you know, this is the kind of thing, I always want to use heroin as the example as opposed to something like pot, which I think probably a majority of Americans have a pretty lenient attitude towards. But I like to go ahead and use heroin as the example and say that, I don't know, look at the drug wars in Mexico going on right now. People are being killed. People use the word drug wars lightly. There are drug wars going on in Mexico right now. And it's all simply because the drugs are illegal.
Yeah.
End of argument. I mean, they can't even hire a police chief in Laredo without him getting a bullet through his heart. And the criminals, the ruthless criminals, have all the motivation in the world to be involved in the drug market, to open up new markets for their drugs, because they make so much money off it, because the prices are so artificially high due to the risk of the distribution, because it's illegal.
Sure, and, you know, with all those black market inflated profits, these gangs can buy and sell many of these law enforcement agencies. Even the national military agencies and the federal agencies are corrupted through and through. Because, you know, I mean, I read a while back a border guard on the American border was caught smuggling all kinds of stuff. And it's just an unworkable system. It's anti-economic to try to prohibit chemicals that people want to ingest. People have been ingesting chemicals for medicinal and recreational purposes for thousands of years, and it's anti-natural and anti-human nature to try to centrally plan this away with some stupid socialist program. And prohibition is socialism. There's no way around it. It's trying to control the means of production and consumption of drugs through the state, and it will fail just like for the same reason communism fails, and it will cause immense human suffering just like any form of socialism.
Well, we can see right now there are 2 million Americans in prison. 2 million, Anthony. Another 5 million on some form of parole or probation, giving urine samples, paying monthly payments to stay out of jail. 7 million people in the criminal justice system in the in this the land of liberty.
Mm-hmm. And most of them are not violent criminals or even property criminals. A lot of them are drug offenders or tax resistors or gun control edict violators.
Right,
or
people who commit an offense against the state rather than a crime against some other person.
Yeah, exactly.
And, of course, the cops, I don't know in your town, at least here in Austin, Texas, the police, apparently the orders come down from the district attorney. Murder whoever you want. We don't care. Especially if they're black and unarmed. Just go ahead and murder them. Just shoot them right in the back. Oh, don't worry. I'll make sure that the grand jury no-bills you. And they can, literally, they can, I don't know, since the millennium turned over and the 20th century became the 21st, the Austin Police Department has murdered, oh, I don't know, it can't be less than 10 of my neighbors. And none of them are held in the slightest bit responsible ever. Ever.
Oh, yeah.
In all capitals, bold italics. Ever.
Sure, and Al Neal Smith, a great libertarian polemicist and sci-fi author, likes to remark that that the police force, the police forces in America, and of course he was saying this before 9/11, which has really accelerated the militarization and nationalization of the city police, but he would say that the police forces are the standing army that the founding fathers warned us against. I mean, there's this conception among certain people on the right, especially, that the police are totally benign. Of course, there are good people in the police. There are good people who, working as police, do things that are not bad or good. But the system itself, it is not a classic American system. It's the police forces as we know them now are mostly a 20th century progressive era phenomenon. The same people who brought us the interstate commerce regulation and the Pure Food and Drug Act.
The Fed,
exactly, the Imperial Wars.
All right, Anthony, but isn't there a problem with, I know the Murray Rothbard maxim is universal rights locally enforced. As you said, hey, liberty is a natural state of being that all humans possess. We're all born free, and the state, if anything, may be there to protect those rights, but they surely don't grant them. But what do we do when we have people who are being terribly oppressed, and never even mind in Iraq? You know, let the people be Saddam Hussein's slave over in Iraq. But what about the people in the South who happen to be black and are being, or at least in the past, terribly oppressed by their local state, which will not locally protect their universal rights? Then what? Don't we need the federal government to come and intervene with the states and make them get along?
Well, that doesn't work very well. That's the worst way to do it. I don't know if you're talking about slavery or
the slavery, or you know, fast forward 100 years to the civil rights era too.
Well, the thing is that a huge amount of the intervention from the federal government, putting aside constitutional questions and all that, was not about was coercive. It was it went far beyond overturning the bad state laws, and they were horrible state laws. And it went on to erect a federal leviathan of civil rights laws that intrude on the rights of private property owners. And you know, I'm not a fan in the least of segregation, especially coerced segregation. But coerced integration is also a violation of rights, and it's not the way to make people get along. You don't make people get along by forcing them, by gunpoint, to associate with people they wouldn't otherwise associate with. And of course, if the social attitudes are far from ideal, this will permeate government. This will affect the way the state enforces any program you imagine. And now we see the perversity of the civil rights regime. It's now used to beat up on private property owners for all sorts of insane reasons. There was one lady who...
Quick.
Okay, a little more than 10 years ago, she sued her company for firing her because she was racist. And she...
Wait. Hold it right there, buddy. Okay. We'll be right back with Anthony Gregory. It's the Weekend Interview Show. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com. Also, I'm an assistant editor for antiwar.com. I'm talking with my buddy, Anthony Gregory. He writes for the Independent Institute, the Future Freedom Foundation, antiwar.com, lewrockwell.com, the Libertarian Enterprise, Liberty Magazine, Strike the Root, and a few other places. So, just put his name in your Google machine and you'll find all kinds of great stuff. Especially, got to recommend his archives at lewrockwell.com and at striketheroot.com. Now, Anthony, we're not going to have time to talk about the welfare state, but we got a pretty right-wing audience around here on Republic, and I don't think they really need to be convinced. So let's go ahead and skip to natural disasters. That's really finally the ultimate bottom-line excuse for having government. But what about when a hurricane strikes? Don't we have to have an all-powerful, easily mobilized, top-down command and control structure to come in and save the day?
Well, as we saw, they didn't save the day. They made everything worse. They kept private charity and private assistance, voluntary charitable assistance out of the disaster area by force. They spent all kinds of time forcibly relocating people, threatening the entire area with orders to shoot people on site if they look too threatening to the order. They disarmed the population of New Orleans, which is not what you do when there's a disaster. You let people protect themselves. You don't go door to door disarming them if your interest is really helping them. And everything that they did was a disaster. This is fairly agreed upon, even by the very pro-public sector left. It was kind of funny to see some conservatives so defensive of FEMA's blundering.
Well, and let's be clear. The purpose of the Federal Emergency Management Agency is not to rescue people. It's to preserve continuity of government. It's to make sure that geographic monopoly you talk about continues to exist no matter what.
That's right.
And then, you know, if we can save you from drowning on the way to secure our monopoly on crime, then, okay, we might help you if we feel like it.
In a crisis, that's right, the state's primary mission is to protect itself. And during wartime, during domestic catastrophes, the state does not come to the defense of the people. It forces and encourages and scares the people into coming to the defense of the state. And this is certainly what happened after 9/11, where the state, you know, they congratulated themselves and gave each other awards and promotions and buffed up their budgets. This has all been these horrible this pork has been very well documented by James Bovard in his work. I recommend that.
And by the way, James Bovard has a new book coming out pretty soon called Attention Deficit Democracy. Hopefully I'll be able to get him on the show to talk about that.
That'd be great, yeah.
Anybody wants to learn more about market anarchism or at least why to reject state power, check out Anthony Gregory's archives at lewrockwell.com. That's lewrockwell.com. Thanks very much for your time today, Anthony. Appreciate it, bud.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, everybody. Website is weekendinterviewshow.com, and I will be back next week with Chris DeLiso, Ron Paul, and Charles Pena. So stay tuned. 2 hours from now, Karen Katowski and Al Lorenz. Or 1 hour from now. Yeah, 1 hour from now. Karen Katowski and Al Lorenz. See you next week.